I was an earnest kid, and I wanted to do all I could for Jesus. And I thought, because of, you know, the free literature that was distributed in our community and what was said on Christian talk radio and other things, that that I should become a Republican president of the United States for Jesus. That was kind of my goal as a young person. And so that very much shaped my life and my ambitions as a young person. And it has continued to shape my life to the extent that that I came to the sort of dead end of the religious right pretty early on.
Welcome to the Unleash Generosity podcast, exploring the intersection of faith, service, philanthropy, and community. I'm your host, Aaron Scott. Thanks for tuning in to this two-part episode where we will be talking with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. You may have heard that there's an election coming up, and Jonathan is somebody who thinks a lot about how his faith engages in the public sphere. But before I give an introduction to Jonathan, I want to encourage you to check out the Unleash Generosity podcast website, which is unleashgenerosity.org. You can also find us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can listen to all past episodes of the podcast on the website. You can also check us out on Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts. So take some time to do a rating or review on the Apple Podcasts site, which will help some other folks find the podcast. That would be wonderful. I appreciate it. 2020 brings us one of the most politically divisive presidential elections in our history. For me and for many other people, there are challenging questions confronting us about how does our faith or our values call us or challenge us to engage in the public square. And as I mentioned, today's guest for a two-part episode is Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. Jonathan is a writer, a nonprofit leader, a Christian speaker, and part of the Red Letter Christian Evangelical Movement. Jonathan is somebody who I met as a young adult when I was recently married and living in Chicago just a few years after graduating from college. His voice and his perspective is one that I've really come to respect and value because I've spent time with him and I've seen him not just talk about what he believes and preach and write books about it, but because he walks the walk. He lives out what he believes are the values that that Christians should be living out in the world today. He's genuinely interested in things that are important to me, and namely discerning what faithfulness to the gospel of Jesus Christ looks like in this time and place. A couple of years ago, Jonathan came to Milligan University, at the time Milligan College, my alma mater where my wife works, and he came to be a chapel speaker. He also preached at my congregation where I attend, Hopwood Christian Church, at a service we call Adoration. And he stayed as a guest in our home. And over the course of that weekend, spending time with him, the times that I've spent time with him at conferences around the country, as well as just my reflections of interacting with him many years ago when I was at Reba Place in Chicago, I've come away with one overarching perspective, and that Jonathan is very genuine. His views are not what you might expect from a white Christian Southern man and a self-proclaimed evangelical. And that's precisely why I was so pleased to be able to take some time to sit down with him and just ask him about his life and have him expand a little bit about his life and how he's come to believe what he believes about American Christianity, about how Christians engage with their faith in a public way, and about why he and his wife have made some of the decisions they've made and their sense of calling to do what they do. Jonathan and his wife, Leah, and their family live in the Walltown neighborhood of Durham, North Carolina. It is a predominantly Black community, and he and his family live at the Rutba House, which is a hospitality house and an intentional Christian community that's part of the New Monasticism movement. In part one of the interview, this episode, we are going to get into his story growing up in rural North Carolina, his political aspirations as a young person, and his relationship with African-American pastor and activist Reverend William Barber, and that the ways in which that relationship really changed his sense of purpose and direction in life. So I hope you're challenged by this conversation with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove.
Hey, Aaron.
How are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm good. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I was trying to think about when we first met. I guess it might have been 2006, 2007, somewhere in there, right up at Reba Place.
That's been a while, hasn't it?
I knew you when you were young, and you knew me when I knew even less than I knew now.
Well, hopefully we're all learning as we go.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about you today, where you live, family, you know, just introduce yourself to the listeners.
Well, my name is Jonathan, and I live in Durham, North Carolina, at the Rootba House, which is a hospitality house and a community of folks who live together and eat together here. We're in a neighborhood called Walltown, mm-hmm. and have tried to learn with our neighbors how to build community in this place and pursue justice, as our city has changed quite a bit over the last 2 decades we've been here. That's where I am today, and have been pretty much without departure since the beginning of this pandemic.
Yeah. Like everyone else, you're probably ready for a little change of scenery, but doesn't seem like it's on the horizon.
Well, it's given us an opportunity to hunker down and pay attention to where we are, that's for sure.
There's a lot of people, I'm sure, that it's helped them like slow down a little bit and be a little bit more rooted. I know that that's something that you've written about in some of your books, The Wisdom of Stability. One of your books comes to mind. Are you hearing that from just other Christians that you interact with? Are people like taking this as the silver lining that maybe it should be, to like, our lives are too crazy, we need to kind of slow down a little bit?
Well, you know, early on during the lockdowns, there was a lot of realignment going on, both in terms of our individual lives and people trying to make sense of, you know, what all kinds of communal activities were going to look like, you know, how churches would continue to meet, how people would do their work, how people would get groceries and all those kind of things. And one of the things that we noticed right away is our community was part of creating this resource for prayer, you know, daily prayer in our homes together. It's called Common Prayer, a Liturgy for Ordinary Radicals. And it's a book, but it's really, it's a community. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of people around the world who pray this together every day. And it was really striking early on. A lot of folks who pray with us got in touch and said, you know, this is really becoming a lifeline, as so much of our life is centered at home, a way to pray and to root ourselves in faith daily, in the daily rhythms of life at home, is important. So we've tried to be responsive to that. And Shane Claiborne and I, who worked on that together, have been hosting a kind of a beginning of the month prayer time together on Zoom each month, just to invite people to gather together and to reflect on the themes for the month. So yeah, I think there's been an attention, at least to the practices that sustain us when we're involuntarily committed to stability.
Yeah. And I use the Common Prayer book myself. I actually, since the app has been kind of redone, I use the app almost every day, which I really enjoy. So thank you for your leadership in bringing that project about. Was that something that was sort of a project specifically as part of School for Conversion, or just kind of a joint thing that you and Shane decided to do together? How did Common Prayer as a resource come about?
Yeah, it is it's a partnership between School for Conversion and The Simple Way. We were the two kind of organizations that gathered people. And under those umbrellas, there were a few dozen people who participated in a process of gathering prayers and stories and practices, songs that had been important to the lives of communities, gathering that together and then putting that in conversation. Shane and Enuma Okoro and I mostly worked to put that kind of a collective contribution in conversation with the long liturgical tradition of the church. So yeah, it's kind of a patchwork quilt. I mean, it's a weaving of all of those things that were important to our communities, a weaving of that into the liturgical traditions to try to, give birth to something that would feel both true to the tradition and authentic to the lives and experience of people in the world today. And it's been gratifying to see that it is helpful to many people in many communities. It's certainly not perfect, and there's often things that I want to edit and tweak. We're trying to put out a 10th anniversary edition next year that has some revisions to it. But it's been a gift to be part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've enjoyed it. We use it at our house, and I've definitely pointed other people to it. And will any of the books, any of your books that are mentioned, or any other resources we talk about, I'll put in the show notes so that listeners can find them.
Hey, this is how we share stuff now, since we don't get together at events or conferences. We get on Zoom together.
Yeah. Strange new times. So let's back up a little bit. I mean, you talked about where you live today, where you're at currently. And we'll probably get in a little bit more to your neighborhood and Walltown and your church, some of that stuff a little bit later. But let's back up to kind of growing up, your experiences growing up. You're from North Carolina originally, right? More rural part of the state.
Yep. I grew up in Stokes County, which is just down the road from Mayberry. If anybody's ever seen the Andy Griffith Show.
Right.
The fellow who wrote that show, his real name was Andy Griffith. He actually grew up in a town called Mount Airy with mm-hmm. my granny and her generation there. Yeah. And that's, rural North Carolina, tobacco country. That's where I come from. Very beautiful land. Those mountains, the Scotch-Irish people who came down from Pennsylvania settled in those mountains many ways, because they're so much like the hill countries that they mm-hmm. had come from. A lot of the folk traditions, people are familiar with, like bluegrass music and mm-hmm. Dolly Parton and those kind of, and all that comes from the old country through the people who settled in those hills. So that's where I'm from. My Uncle Tom, he played the banjo on the WPAQ, the local radio station's Saturday night bluegrass show for decades. And his brother, Otis, was the town drunk. So Andy patterned his town drunk in the Andy Griffith Show after my Uncle Otis.
Interesting.
That's our claim to fame right there.
Yeah, that makes your family proud, doesn't it?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. So a lot of those same, where people come from and the same traditions, you're not too far from where we live. So
that's right. Western North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee, we've got a lot in common. Y'all just say your eyes a little longer over there. That's what I noticed growing up. If somebody was from the other side of the mountains, they'd say light and bright and might. We kind of garbled them in the back of our throat.
Yeah. But we agreed on the music. We agreed on certain things, sweet tea and all those sweet kinds tea. Of things. So you had, a
banana pudding. Do y'all make banana puddings over there?
It's not a big thing around here. Is that thing in local diners and restaurants, banana pudding?
Yeah, that's our greatest dessert over here.
All right. Banana pudding. We're missing out here on the Tennessee side. So talk about formational experiences other than, banana pudding growing up. I mean, what was it like for you being involved as a young person in Stokes County, North Carolina, formative experiences in terms of politics or Christianity or education?
Well, I was raised up in the Baptist church, which was not just the center of our spiritual life, but also of community life. I mean, all the jobs I worked growing up, in tobacco fields and hoeing corn and those kind of things were for people that I knew from church. And that was very much a community center. And those folks loved me well. My Sunday school teachers made me memorize the Bible. We memorized it in the King James Version.
Mm-hmm.
It was good enough for Jesus. It was good enough for us. We weren't going to change anything. And
at what point did you realize Jesus didn't read the King James Version?
Well, we took it. I don't remember exactly, but I still love the King right. Jimmy. Partly because it's just what's inside of me, and the Psalms are beautiful in that old translation. But you were asking about formation, and one of the things I realized in my own life is that I grew up in that community at precisely the moment when hundreds of millions of dollars were invested in mobilizing our community and communities like ours for a right-wing political coalition. We didn't know that at the time, but I've increasingly come to realize that that was very much the project that I was caught up in. And I you know, very much, I was an earnest kid and I wanted to do all I could for Jesus. And I thought because of, you know, the free literature that was distributed in our community and what was said on Christian talk radio and other things, that that I should become a Republican president of the United States for Jesus. That was kind of my goal as a young person. And so that very much shaped my life and my ambitions as a young person. And it has continued to shape my life to the extent that that I came to the sort of dead end of the religious right pretty early on. And because of that, I had to wrestle with what had allowed me to be so caught up in that, so deceived by the sort of simple connection of my faith, not only to a political party, but to a political coalition that was essentially, as I've come to understand it, it was essentially a push back against the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement of the mid 20th century. So I've had to wrestle with why did that happen, and what did that have to do with racism in this country? What did it have to do with the way faith gets manipulated and misused? And how could I learn to be Christian in a way that would be faithful to not to, to Jesus and to the scriptures and to my neighbors in this country?
And I recently reread your book, Free to Be Bound, Church Beyond the Color Line, which really talks a lot about racial justice issues in American culture, but largely in the church. You talk a lot in the early part of the book about your first interactions with Reverend William Barber and meeting him and sort of developing a relationship with him. Was that the season in which, like you said, you pretty early on, you kind of started to unravel this kind of relationship between power and money and how it was influencing the religious right and Christianity? Was meeting Reverend Barber a part of that sort of season where you were kind of starting to say, these things don't make sense in my mind?
Oh, my dear brother is the reason that I think I'm still a Christian today, because when I hit that dead end and knew I couldn't continue in the only way that I had ever imagined a connection between faith and public life, he came right along and took me under his wing and taught me the tradition that he was raised in, you know, the tradition of Martin Luther King and Fannie Lou Hamer and Clarence Jordan and, you know, many other Christians who've lived a very different way of following Jesus. And that's been a great gift to me.
How old were you when you met Reverend Barber for the first time? Do you remember?
I was 17 years old, just off the fall of my junior year in high school, where I had paged in the U.S. Senate for Senator Strom Thurmond. And that was my, you know, first step into the big city and my first kind of opportunity to be on the inside of right-wing politics. For those of your listeners who may not remember, Strom Thurmond was the Dixiecrat candidate for president in 1948. He filibustered the 1957 Civil Rights Act on the floor of the Senate for over 24 hours. I think he still holds the record for the longest filibuster in the Senate. And, you know, he was a segregationist who never gave up his commitment to white supremacy, but changed his tune and led all the Dixiecrats into the Republican Party, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And yeah, in many ways, working for him was what helped me to see how the religious right had used Christian faith to line up communities like mine with a white voting coalition that didn't think of itself as voting based on race, but as voting based on our faith.
But in fact, that was the kind of bait and switch. I was listening to another podcast you did recently on with Inspired, and you tell some stories. So I don't want to cover all the same stories that you talked about in that interview, because I'll link to it. And that's a great 55 minutes or hour spent if people want to check out that interview, because you talk a lot about I think you used that term bait and switch, that they wouldn't characterize it that way, but basically they were trying to get Christians to vote based on racist ideas.
That's right. And, you know, I don't want to suggest that that's an unusual thing. I think I think the thing I've had to come to learn is that's how racism has always worked. You know, racism has always been perpetuated. White supremacy has been perpetuated in this country by convincing white people that it's actually good. And it's actually, you know, the way of life that is best, not just for them, but for black and brown people. You know, it's, we often hear these days the claim made by the current president that he's done more for black people than any president in U.S. history. And while I think there's a lot to be argued that that claim is not true, it should also be said that that has been the claim of every white supremacist in the history of this country. It's always the claim that it's best for everybody. So I think it's helpful for us to, as we grapple with the systemic nature of inequality in our society, it's helpful to just get down to the basic reality that, you know, racism is not, you know, some angry person in the corner who yells mean words at people who aren't like him. That's just kind of a side effect of the divisive tactics that racism uses.
Yeah.
Racism is establishing a system that treats people unequally and arguing that it's actually the best system possible, and that, in fact, God blesses that system and wants it to continue.
And that's part of the thing, you know, as a Christian, that I was realizing, I guess, around the time we were meeting, you know, because I had grown up in a predominantly white church and white community outside Cleveland, Ohio, came down to Milligan, studied at a predominantly white Christian college. And it wasn't really until I got into college and started kind of confronting some of my own bubble that I had been in and realizing that the story was more complex. And some of the things that I had believed about politics and religion and how they came together, like, oh, there were parts of my Christian history that were not told to me because they're not very flattering, because the church has perpetuated racism in a lot of ways. So it's like kind of facing into that was problematic and troubling. How much of what we need to be doing as Christians is just, does that begin with sort of repentance? Like, if we can't acknowledge that we've been a part of the problem, there's really, it's hard to even get started on reconciliation or healing. Is that kind of what you see as a really important first step for white Christians?
Well, that's true for all sin. I often think of what Karl Barth said, that we only know sin on the way out, right? So in some ways, you can't confess, you can't repent, you can't even name what it is until you begin to see a way out of it. And that's grace, right? Grace is our God ultimately meets us where we are and offers us a way out. And I think that's the gift that Reverend Barber gave me. Reverend Barber, you know, a black pastor and a political activist, came to my very white community understanding, you know, the worldview and the vision of a society that I had been raised in. And he came and explained to me and to the community I was part of that that racism had been used against us, right? This is what poor white folks often don't understand, that systemic inequality has been used to prop up a system where a pretty small minority of the people have always had most of the wealth. And in particular, over the last 70 years in this country, we've seen that gap between, you know, the very rich and most of us just, you know, turn into a big wide canyon.
Yeah.
And a lot of white folks are hurting. You know, that's partly what the opioid crisis is about. That's what, you know, that's what we're talking about in terms of living wages. You know, the fact that, I mean, a lot of people know that you can work two or three jobs now. And your, you know, husband or wife can work two or three jobs and still not be able to pay the bills and send the kids to school and have health insurance. And these are the kinds of things that weigh on many white communities, predominantly white communities in the country. And yet the Du Bois called the wages of whiteness have always been this, you know, this narrative that people are fed over and over again that says, you know, you might not have much, but at least you're better than those people. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, at one time that was mostly, at least you're better than the black sharecroppers. You know, you might be a sharecropper with, you know, nothing but a shack with a hole in the floor, but at least you're not, you know, those folks down the road. But increasingly, you know, that's been, at least you're not, you know, somebody from across the border. At least you're not a Muslim. But these demonizing and criminalizing narratives that pretend that, you know, some people made in the image of God are not like other people made in the image of God, you know, that there's some sort of fundamental difference. That is the lie that's been used to prop up a system that's incredibly unequal and that I think ultimately God's justice demands that we challenge and transform.
And so you talk about in the book, Reverend Barber coming and visiting your church and visiting your community and him or somebody who was in his party talking about your community being like Klan country and they wouldn't have been there after dark. Mm-hmm. Was that an eye-opening thing to you that like you all of a sudden saw your own community through a different lens that you couldn't see it through without somebody of color pointing that out?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah. We were not proud of racism. As a matter of fact, we were taught growing up that we had moved on from racism, you know. And often I think that's the sort of foil that the Klan plays. You know, like, you know, we that this notion that we are good white people, you know, not like those Klansmen or not like those, you know, white nationalists who march in the streets and, you know, shout and scream that the Jews won't replace us or, you know, white folks have been taught to see those things as extremism, but to see white cultural norms as normal. Yeah. And I think it was eye-opening for me as a young person to meet people who I already respected and wanted to learn from, who told me that, you know, they had grown up being told not to come to a place like where I lived after dark because they knew it was dangerous to them. Hmm.
So in a lot of ways, I mean, your career and your life from that sort of foundation, growing up in the South, being a Christian, but then kind of confronting how American political power and money was influencing American Christianity in your upbringing. A lot of your career, a lot of things you've written about, what you've done with your life in some ways has not been following in the footsteps of Strom Thurmond and going into seeking political office or whatever, but it was in some ways very much shaped by that and is still mm-hmm. informed by that. And a lot of the work you've done has been addressing those kinds of challenges and problems. Mm-hmm. As you left the South and went on to college, you went up to Eastern University in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Tell us about, it strikes me that from what I know about you and the time we've spent together, that was a whole nother layer of kind of thinking about, so then what does like being faithful in America as a Christian look like then? Mm-hmm. And it seems like maybe some of the other things that you had to do some unlearning at that stage too, and were exposed to some different traditions. If Reverend Barber exposed you to what faithfulness might look like, you also met some other people in Pennsylvania that challenged some of your thinking and also maybe showed you some other alternative ways to follow Jesus. What do you recall as you think about those college years and post-college years when you were up at Eastern? What were some of the formative things that happened there?
Well, I went to Eastern because I had met Tony Campolo, and Tony was representative of an evangelical tradition that had not accepted what I take to really be a false dichotomy between, you know, a personal relationship with Jesus and work for justice in the world, between the need for racial justice and the need for evangelism. And Tony was an evangelist who traveled quite a bit back then and had been preaching down here in North Carolina and introduced me to that tradition. So I had an opportunity at Eastern to be connected to a multiracial evangelical tradition that that takes Jesus and justice seriously. And so, I've remained connected to a network that Tony helped to start called Red Letter Christians, which has been a fellowship of what are sometimes, you know, called prophetic evangelicals. But I think it's important that we remember, especially when, you know, in public life or in conversations, in terms that try to clarify differences, we sometimes lump people together. And a lot of times in political reporting these days, you hear about white evangelicals, and that's assumed that means right wing. It means, you know, aligned with the Republican Party. It means, you know, that people are committed to a certain way of understanding their faith in relationship to public life. And that, while that's certainly true of many people, that's not true of the white Christians I got to know, the white evangelicals I got to know at Eastern College. So it was good to be introduced to a different tradition, and to know that that has a real place in our life and in the life of the church.
Yeah, and then at that time you met your wife in college. Is that right?
Indeed, yes. Okay. Actually, on the first day, it took me some time to persuade her to be as interested in that relationship as I was. But yes, it was a great gift of being at Eastern was meeting her.
Do you like send them donations in honor of the fact that you helped me find my wife?
I'm sure they would appreciate that. In the dark, if I open my heart
and my eyes, I can see. Well, thanks for tuning in for part one of the episode. In part two, we're going to continue talking about Jonathan's time in Pennsylvania at Eastern University. And we're also going to talk about some other influences that he experienced during his college years and post-college years that were very influential to his theology and to the direction that he would eventually take. We will talk a little bit more about some of the work that Jonathan is doing today with the Poor People's Campaign in conjunction with Reverend Barber. Please check out the show notes, which include links to Inspired, a podcast in which Jonathan has a really enlightening conversation to learn a little bit more about Jonathan's work and his views. I've linked to a couple of his books that came up as a part of our conversation, including Common Prayer, Free to Be Bound, Church Beyond the Color Line, as well as some links to some other resources that came up as a part of our conversation, Eastern University, Red Letter Christians, and the Christian Community Development Association, or CCDA. All of that in the show notes. And yeah, I hope you can check out part two of my conversation with Jonathan in episode 10. And until next time, unleash your own generosity. As you fight the dark.